Please, please, hey. where the music ends and where the man begins. All gates are open now for you and for me. How we blend into each other's symphony. And your breathing sound is really eating me. It doesn't seem much so.
Thank you. television. And that's all he got was his foot background in a tourist shot. And his face framed by those old Roman leaves. Dead center on the front of a five spot. And his face framed by those old Roman leaves. Dead center on the front of a five spot.
Tupac and Biggie jumped the gun. Jesus Christ jumped the gun. Malcolm X jumped the gun. Mahatma Gandhi jumped the gun. John F. Rock jumped the gun.
Black stripes. Addicted, ego-driven condition has become not simply the source of our own unhappiness, that was bad enough, but now it's the source of great discomfort and dislocation for all life and human society on the planet. We are out of control. We are basically severely addicted to things and cannot stop ourselves. And we know, or we should know, that there is not enough petroleum, heavy metal, so forth and so on, in the planet to give all the thing addicts all the things that we know they must have in order to be happy. We have spread this intellectual virus from pole to pole, to Turkmenistan and Borneo, to the upper Amazon and to the Tajiks. What are we going to do about this? Well, so far, we've been treating it like an endless garden party. There's no serious plan on the table to deal with this at all. Culture is a shabby lie, or at least this culture is a shabby lie. I mean, if you work like a dog,
you get 260 channels of bad television and a German automobile. What kind of perfection is that? Our secular society, religion is completely devalued, and consumer objectivism. The only kind of worth that we collectively recognize. I'm sure you've all seen the t-shirt that says, he who dies with the most toys wins. That is, in fact, the banner under which we're flying here. And the level of unhappiness is immense. I mean, the level of unhappiness among the poor, they've always been miserable. But we've managed to create something entirely new in human history, an utterly miserable ruling class. I mean, there seems to be no excuse for that. There is life carrying. What is this all about? Is it carrying us toward extinction? So that the rest of nature can heave an enormous sigh of relief and then get back to the business of nest building, mating flights, and overposturing, and whatever it is that they're doing out there? Or is it carrying us toward some kind of a transition?
No one of us, I think, can imagine that history could go on for another 1,000 years. I mean, what would it look like at the current rate of population growth, spread of epidemic disease, rate of invention, connectivity, depletion of resources, the atmosphere? It is impossible to conceive of another 1,000 years of human history. History then is ending. History is a kind of gestation process. It's a kind of metamorphosis. It's an episode in the life of a species. If you think of the simple example of metamorphosis, that of caterpillar to butterfly, we all know that there is this intermediate resting stage where the caterpillar is, for all practical purposes, enzymatically dissolved and then reconstituted as an entirely different kind of organism with different physical structures, different eyes, different legs, a different way of breathing, with wings where no wings were before, with a different kind of feeding apparatus. This is what's happening to us. History is a process of metamorphosis. It's a pupation stage. It begins with naked monkeys, and it ends with a human-machine planet-girdling interface capable of releasing the energies that light the stars. And it lasts about 15 or 20,000 years, and during that period, the entire process hangs in the balance. It's a period of high risk. It's like what a butterfly is doing in a cocoon, or what is happening to a child in the womb. It's a gestation process where one form of life is being changed into another.
What the psychedelic experience does, really, is it stretches the envelope of the imaginable. I mean, what can be imagined can be created. What cannot be imagined is not part of the play.
But the psychedelics dissolve that boundary as well. And so they promote a larger sense of the world than the values of capitalism, competitiveness, object fetishism, property acquisition, and the bottom line in power. When I say psychedelic, I have something very specific in mind that a substance or a plant should do. It should not inhibit clarity. In other words, not episodes of forgetfulness, lack of memory, passing out, or confusion. It shouldn't interfere with that, and it should transform thought. and it should be accompanied by visual hallucinations with eyes closed. They dissolve boundaries within the psyche, between the conscious and unconscious mind. They dissolve the boundaries that separate people. They dissolve boundaries of time and space. Most people profit from boundary dissolution. It introduces them to the wider horizon of reality. But there are among us people for whom the maintenance of boundaries is a daily struggle. They are trying to create an ego, trying to create a coherent view of the world. These are certainly not the candidates for the psychedelic experience. My concern is that the fearful among us have set the social agenda for all of us. And so we are all told this is somehow corrosive of social values, somehow compromising of sanity. The psychedelic experience is the most intense experience a human being can have this side of the yawning grave. The boundary dissolving capacity of these psychedelic substances act, as it were, like a reset button. We are not ultimately the creatures of our culture. Ultimately, we are biologically defined. And what the psychedelics do, I think, is just inject an enormous amount of distance between ourselves and our learned cultural values.
The ultimate boundary dissolution is the dissolution of ego. I mean, we straight people hope that they never meet it except at death. Of course, they don't realize going to sleep at night is a kind of ego dissolution. But the government is expressive of this dominator culture that we're living in. The ego is a very recent invention, and its hold on reality is very tenuous. And consequently, it walks around imbued with fear. I mean, it feels itself to be a mouse in a world of dinosaurs. That's because it's a very recent development.
History is some kind of a phase transition. It only lasts about 25,000 years. Some people think that's a long time. Some people think it's a short time. It depends on where you stand. I think of it as snap. You know, one moment you're hunting ungulates on the plains of Africa, and the next moment you're hurling a gold ytterbium superconducting extra stellar device toward Alpha Centauri, with all of mankind aboard in virtual space being run as a simulation in circuitry. You know? It's just first one thing, then the other thing. But now history, which lasts 25,000 years, is this weird period where you're neither fish nor fowl. You know, you're not the hunting ape anymore, but you are not yet the 16-dimensional digital god, you know? And in that transition phase, there is confusion, there is angst. But now we're at the end. I maintain anybody who's peddling angst and peddling pessimism and peddling all this stuff is just, that's so 2 minutes ago.
So, you may say to yourself, well, this is all very interesting. This guy has some kind of anthropologically revisionist theory, and, you know, that's all well and good. In other words, so what? What does it have to do with us? Well, what it has to do with us is we are in a state of enormous dysfunctional anxiety as a result of the fall into history, which has caused us to have to compromise our sensuality, our connection to the Gaian goddess, our polymorphic sexuality. All of these things have been poured into a new set of social institutions that derive essentially from the invention of agriculture, which is where I think the shit hit the fan. I mean, I'm fairly radical on that. I think that agriculture is the end because it's incredibly successful as a strategy for food production. Well, what does that mean? It means you can't be nomads anymore. Oh no, you have to build a stone tower to put the grain in. And you have to make sure you can haul large rocks up on top of your tower to drop on people whose grain crop wasn't as big as yours was. We see this at Jericho. The most advanced building in the world of 10,000 BC was the grain tower at Jericho. And it was defensive, and it bespeaks, you know, the primal paranoia. Once people stopped moving across the land, once they violated it with the blade of the plow, then you get sedentary populations. The division between the profane world of the city and the wilderness outside. That's the moment when the division between the unconscious and the conscious mind comes into play. And an entire set of institutions arise then. Male kingship, standing armies, role specialization, slavery, women as chattel, so forth and so on. I mean, we are the unhappy inheritors of this hideous plunge into dysfunctionality. Now, why is it such a hideous plunge into dysfunctionality to live without psilocybin or close relatives thereof? The answer is that this thing, which to now I've described as male dominance and a tendency to form dominance hierarchies, we can describe another way and bring much closer to home by saying it is the ego. The ego is a late arriving, very tenuous, highly uncertain of itself, social structure that has taken root in the human psyche like a tumor, like a growth of some sort. It is the leftover of this primate dominance complex. And the way it manifests itself is by the establishment of boundaries. First of all, this is my body. Do not touch it. Second of all, these are my weapons and agricultural tools. Do not touch them. This is my woman. These are my children. I hunt there. So forth and so on. It's this division of the world that allows the illusion of the ego to come into existence. Now, what do psychedelics do, and why are they such social dynamite? The answer is, it's not a health issue. It's not an addiction issue. It's not, I mean, that's preposterous. It's about boundary dissolution. Every society, from the classic Maya to Fujiwara, Japan, to the France of the Bourbons, every society establishes a set of boundaries, which it then calls reality, and woe betide you if you go across the boundary, because then you are outcast, outclass, outlandish, and the full fury of the community can be turned against you, and we all know what that can mean as pagans. So I believe that the ego is a dysfunctional psychic invader, and that it will continue to strengthen and perpetuate itself as long as we do not institute, either as groups or within our relationships or as individuals, a regular ritual encounter with the forces which dissolve these boundaries. And the only force I know that works are these plants. And as I say, I'm not interested in arguing whether there are other methods or not. God, I would hope so. But anything I ever looked into, and I shopped the spiritual supermarket from stem to stern, was horseshit as far as I could see. Now, I am not a sensitive. Let me say that. People say, well, but what about Ramana Maharshi and what about Yaka Burma? And hey, it's great for those folks. I applaud arhats and avatars and so forth and so on. But what I'm interested in is democratic ecstasis. It should be for the most lumpen among us. It is not to be attained by an act of dietary control, sexual abstinence, or whatever. It is a human birthright. It is a human birthright to touch the incorporeal body of the goddess. It isn't something. So, let's see, where can we go from here? I say all this, if you're interested, I say it better than I'm saying it here, in my book, Food of the Gods, which was not written for you people. It's an argument for people who do not know a great deal about drugs, may never have taken drugs, but through some miracle have managed to maintain an open mind. I don't know how much you know about my shtick, and I can't get into it now, but for me, these things are more the tools for exploring Freudian or Jungian unconscious. I mean, I journey to inhabited worlds there are echoes in Elfland and Fae, but, as a rationalist, as a aspiring astronautical engineer at age 13, it's astonishing to me that I could validate the mystery through doubt. Through doubt. Truth is real. You can beat it on the ground. You can rip it apart. You can look inside it. Nobody needs to guard the truth from inspection. Nobody needs to tell you that, you can't look behind the stage. And so my motivation is to try to, number one, bring people to the realization that the spiritual path, if you want to think of it that way, that is a real thing, and it will carry you to the real thing. All spiritual disciplines that I know, except for psychedelics, put a great deal of emphasis on putting the pedal to the metal. Push, 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 meditate, make offerings, do mantrayana, do pranayama, do pusha, push, push, push. With psychedelics, suddenly there's a very deep interest in, and where are the brakes? You see? You're no longer pushing. Once you get to the psychedelics, seeking is an attitude which ill becomes you. You have found it. You have found it. Now, what in the hell are you going to do with it? And this is a great dilemma for anyone who goes into this. I mean, I am, as I see myself, I'm I'm a preacher in the marketplace. But I know, and I'm sure most of you know, that I could walk out of here, you could walk out of here, and you could go as far as your courage would carry you. There is no barrier. There are no more barriers. You can go as far as your fucking courage will carry you. And at that point, you have to ask the question, you know, do I want to be the mad monk of Cold Mountain? Do I want the villagers to down in the valley to say, oh yes, we see him occasionally up in the mist, naked, flying with the eagles? Because you can be that person. You know, you don't have to go back to your job as ad exec, stockbroker, or whatever it is. And so we stand on the edge of being able to leave history. We can leave it. You know, we tend to forget, because our lives are so brief, that what we call the psychedelic experience is very, very new on the plate of Western occultism and science. I mean, hashish did not make great inroads into medieval Europe. That all came later in the 18th and 19th century. Chloroform, ether, these things don't cut it. Mescaline was synthesized for the first time in 1888. These things had to compete with many other interesting areas of scientific exploration in the 20th century. We have not come to terms with what they mean and what they are. And it's a curious area, because the counterculture, whatever that may mean, knows a great deal more about this than science. I mean, science does not explore this area because it senses enormous danger for its ontological machinery. It probably couldn't survive the encounter, and therefore it's just said, well, it's psychology, it's marginal, it's fleeting, it's non-irreproducible, and so forth and so on. This is all nonsense. You can, by unplugging the telephone, by fasting for 6 hours, and by taking 5 dried grams of prepared chupansis in silent darkness, you can go up to the great simulacra of human explorers, Hypatia, Maria, Newton, Da Vinci. You can take that ride. I have the feeling that when we go into those psychedelic spaces, we not only see things no one has ever seen before, we see things no one will ever, ever see again.
reasonable advice, too, I think. Where the problem area lies, people think it lies in taking too much. It lies in taking too little. Because if you take too little, you can resist it. You can struggle with it. And then it can turn into a real mess because you're afraid of it. And you actually have the power to some degree to resist it. What you want to do is take sufficiently enough that there's no escape and that the transition from ordinary reality to fully loaded is as quick as possible, because the going up is somewhat terrifying. For example, let's use psilocybin as the model. Here's how it works for me. This is not tea. This is eating raw mushrooms. It comes on more slowly. So after an hour or so, you know, and the way I do it is I sit as soon as the mushroom enters my body, I sit and meditate. I noticed in South America they don't do it like this. They dose the ayahuasca. And then everybody just goes on talking about their motorcycles and the jobs at the sawmill and who's conning. It's like totally, they toss it. There's a brief moment, they pour, they toss it down. Then they all go back to raving at each other about mundane life. And then 30 minutes later, on the dot, the shaman blows his whistle or shakes his shakyapa, his leaf. Dry leaf bouquet, and everybody settles down, and it's like it comes on within 2 minutes. As soon as the guy starts singing, he just invokes it. The way I do it is I take the mushroom or the ayahuasca, and then I sit and I roll bombers, so I'll have them ready if I need them, and I just sit as I'm going to sit during the trip, and I've unplugged the telephone, and I've gotten everything squared away, and it begins to come on at about the 40-minute or the 60-minute mark, and there's sometimes some nausea as it comes on, and then I smoke a bomber or half a bomber, and then it catapults it into the full deployment of the thing, where you just hang on. There's about a 25-minute period where all your only job is to hang on. It builds. It's like watching an atomic explosion on the other side of 50 feet of absolutely clear crystal glass. I mean, you can't believe this is happening, quote unquote, in my mind. You have the feeling that everybody from Seattle to San Diego is just crawled under their desk as this thing tore past, but it's in your mind. And then there is the interaction with it, which moment to moment you are pretty coherent, but you lose it. A lot of it does not transcribe into short-term memory. And then after about an hour or 40 minutes of that, it becomes more manageable, more memorable. The most mind-boggling parts of it are just not possible to bring out of it because language fails. Because English, there are no words. There are no words even close. I mean, sometimes you'll bring out an image or a metaphor, but out of 5 hours of tripping, you bring out, you know, half a notebook page of metaphors, and yet you were entirely engaged during that time. Now, this question about fear, which is a real question, because when everything begins to slide, it's more than most people who haven't done it expect. They have heard it, they've read the books, but they think it's a metaphor. They don't understand. It's really going to happen, and it's really going to happen to you. And there's a tendency to clutch or to try and resist it. The thing to do in those situations, I think, and it's counterintuitive to how Western people think, but the thing to do is to sing, to sit up not to assume the fetal position. See, what you might tend to do is assume the fetal position and tell yourself, my God, this is the most appalling thing that's ever happened to me. If I can just live through it, it'll be all right. I've taken this drug. If I can just wait through. How long did they say it will be? 7 hours. I see it started 2 minutes ago. If I can just... No, the thing to do is to sit up and to sing. And why? Well, being practical people, to oxygenate your brain, to move this thing that's happened to you, though it may have one claw in heaven, its roots are in your neurophysiology, I mean the chemistry of the drug. You want to move your physiology around. So oxygenating your brain can't fail to do this. So you sing, and this almost always is accompanied by a sense of power, control, equilibrium, and so forth and so on. Not always. I mean, let's face it, you're a product of a nutty society, and there are unexamined crevices and uncleaned out drain traps in all of us, and you're going to encounter that stuff. The good news is the earlier psychedelic trips tend to deal with that. If you will quickly discover taking psychedelics that either you can work through your personal issues and become a psychedelic explorer, or this is just stronger medicine than you are up for, and you would be far better to go back to psychoanalysis or whatever works for you. Some people just can't take it. Why is that? Well, because what it does is it dissolves boundaries, and most of us are over boundary defined, but some of us are having an uphill battle getting some boundaries in place and realizing we are not the telephone or the tree or the person we live with. And so for those people who are having trouble establishing and maintaining boundaries, this is the last thing on earth they should get for. Cannabis. Yeah.
You're in the state that you're experiencing that full lack of ego or boundary. Is it possible that your physical self could just literally stop? Because I have...
Well, people often... Yes, wonders. Often people wonder. You get into a place where it's so unfamiliar that the question comes up, have I done it this time? You know, am I dying or am I in danger? The answer is, the odds are incredibly against you being seriously in danger. People don't die from psychedelics unless they have heart conditions or some incredibly rare medical condition. The problem is that the ego feels threatened by the boundary dissolution. And its ace is your self-identification with it. And it can actually say to you, you are dying. And here's the evidence. And you have to say, no, it's unlikely. And sing your way through it. But this is really tough. I mean, the Buddhists talk about slaying the ego. This is slaying the ego for real. You must slay it, otherwise it will spread panic into your whole psychological system, will give way to panic and hysteria. So unless there is some real reason to think you're dying, and you should have done your homework, you should know what to expect. For example, if you take LSD and begin intense bouts of vomiting, this is not a proper reaction to LSD. Something is wrong, either with the LSD or with your relationship to it. You should know because a typical trip will put you through changes, but but is not dangerous. But if you suddenly begin exhibiting some symptom, heart fibrillation or something like that, then you want to have... this is why then there's always the issue of the buddy system. Should there be somebody else there? And what about all that? My position is, if you're anxious, then you should have a sitter. If you're going to do it alone, you should certainly tell someone so that they will check on you after a while. I don't like doing it in groups or with sitters, because inevitably I get spun into them. What I want to do is go as deep as possible and be it. And even if I'm alone with one other person, culture is the third guest at the table, you know. If you start, I mean, I've often found myself in the middle of psychedelic trips thinking, I'm sure glad there's nobody else here to see this, because I'm sure it would alarm an observer, because I have my leg thrown back up over my neck and I'm screaming in Urdu or something. But it's okay. After a few minutes, it's okay. But if there were an observer, they would feel the need to do something, you know. And often, like, I've seen people smoking DMT, and people moan, and they say, no, no, no. And they moan, and so then, you know, you get them back together and constituted, and you say, how was it? And they say, it was fantastic. So you realize, you know, how they present is not reliable.
This is Ringo, and you have just finished my favorite episode of the Elastic Retreat with DJ Dead to the World, on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more. I could not imagine my life without the Fab Four and Spirit Plants Radio. Keep listening.